This is Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Earlier this month, the New York Times Magazine marked the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first enslaved Africans to the shores of Virginia with the 1619 Project. This collection of essays, photographs, and poetry explores how slavery and its aftermath continue to shape the nation. Moderator Kathleen Schock got reaction to the project from Dr. Paula Parks, professor of English at Bakersfield College, Drs. Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts, professors of history at Fresno State, and Dorothy Smith, a retired educator and community activist.
Dr. Parks, I'd like to start with you. You've read through the 1619 Project. Tell me, what are your initial reactions to this piece of work?
It's a really powerful piece of work. Between the poetry, the prose, and the researched articles, it shows slavery and its aftermath from so many different angles, from the creative to the scholarly. It's very well done. It was sad reading parts of it. I was mad reading parts of it, and other parts I was just learning more about how deep the roots of slavery are in the beginning of our country.
Dr. Roberts, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. One of the essays that's in the project is by New York Times reporter Nikita Stewart, and it's titled, Why We Can't Teach Slavery Right in American Schools. I know you've written a book about the memory of slavery. Could you talk a little bit about how that memory has evolved over time and how it may vary from the lived experience of those who lived through the institution of slavery?
Sure. So I think it's important for us to always keep in mind that when we talk about the memory of slavery, that enslaved African Americans and their descendants always understood slavery for what it was. And that was a brutal, inhumane institution that was based on violence. And it was about theft. And while they nurtured those memories after the abolition of slavery in families and churches, often in segregated schools, the memory of slavery that really developed elsewhere, kind of in mainstream white American society, was quite different. It owed itself to white slave owners before the Civil War who defended slavery as a positive, benevolent institution that, quote unquote, civilized slaves. Those slave owners had said that their slaves were well taken care of, they were cared for, and essentially suggested that slavery was the natural condition for slaves. That narrative of slavery really continued to exist after the abolition of slavery and became the dominant narrative in many school systems throughout the United States. So, for example, one of the things that you start to see in the late 1800s and the early 1900s in particular is a group like the United Daughters of the Confederacy in the South pushing to make sure that textbooks adopted by school systems had that portrait of slavery, that memory of slavery as a benevolent institution. And they were very successful. If they found textbooks that told the truth about slavery, that talked about its violence, if they found textbooks that said slavery is the cause of the Civil War, they said to school districts, to state boards of education, those textbooks must be taken out of the classroom. So that's an example of how the kind of whitewashed memory of slavery, if you will, became institutionalized in our educational system across the United States. And that interpretation really continued to exist in many places throughout much of the 20th century.
Go ahead.
If I can jump in there, what's important, I think, is that started primarily as a Southern interpretation, this whitewashed interpretation. It merges with slaveholders and then their descendants. But it becomes national. It spreads nationwide with these textbook campaigns, and it becomes embraced by leading academics in the early 20th century. People teaching at Harvard and Yale and Columbia and Princeton. I actually brought a quotation just to sort of illustrate that that I would read. It's offensive, so warning. But this is from a popular U.S. history textbook from the 1930s and 1940s called The Growth of the American Republic. It was written by two leading historians at the time. And this is how it characterized slavery and the enslaved. Slaves were, quote, adequately fed, well cared for and apparently happy. African Americans were, quote, a race with exasperating habits. They were childlike, improvident, and superstitious. And then it goes on later. As for Sambo, again, this is a quotation, there is some reason to believe that he suffered less than any other class in the South. Although brought to America by force, the incurably optimistic Negro soon became attached to the country and devoted to his white folks. And so what I think the 1619 Project is doing, and it's not the first to do this, but it is underscoring the reality of slavery, that slavery is nothing like this, that this was a whitewashed fantasy that was created in the late 19th and early 20th century, spread across the country, and it's only been recently that people have started to show it for what it really is.
Dr. Parks, in the 1619 Project, this whole misunderstanding, mischaracterization of slavery has what was called by one academic, educational malpractice. I'm just wondering from your perspective, how do you think our understanding of slavery became so warped over time, and what can be done to right this wrong?
I think the way, and I teach at Bakersfield College, and I coordinate a program for African-American students, and we're going into our fifth year. I would think that using resources and textbooks that show slavery as it was, one of the books that I'm using this semester and I've used before is Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by Dr. Joy DeGruy. And it goes into detail about what slavery was and how it was attempted to be whitewashed and how things were made up to show African Americans as deficient intellectually, didn't have emotion, so it didn't matter if you sold families apart from each other. And it goes into great detail, and the students need that information. They need to know what really happened. And then there's a chapter at the end of the book on healing, because you can't just, you know, open wounds and then just leave them open. It's like, what do you do with the fact that you're angry and upset about what happened to your ancestors? And that's what's so upsetting. It's like, you know, people in your family went through this. And that's what it's like for me and for the students. And then how do we heal? How do we get past this? How do we talk about the issues and then come out better on the other side?
You know, one of the points of this project is to document the way in which slavery continues to shape our lives today, whether we're Black or white. Dorothy Smith, I'd like to bring you into the conversation and hear your thoughts about this. You spent decades as an educator, and I am wondering from your perspective, how do you see the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow continue to reverberate here in the Central Valley?
An experience that I had, I want to share this with you, is that before I retired, one of my little African-American girls came to me. She was describing the student to me, another black student. And so she said, "Miss Smith, you know the one with the good hair?" "Good hair." And I said, "You mean like mine?" She said, "No, the one with the good hair, Miss Smith." And I'm thinking, a little black girl in 2015, we're still talking good hair. And that's a thing from the whitewashed brain mentality that we have, that if you have so-called hair that's closer to white, and if you're light, bright, gray eyes, those types of things, well, you've got it made. And so when she said that to me, and I'm thinking, in this day and age, people are still talking about good hair. And the remnants of slavery, I won't live to see the good part of it, but we still need to continue to fight the good fight. And we still need to understand, you know, when I see people like you, and I'm, if you don't mind me saying this, as white people sitting across from me who've done some studies, when I was in college, I got mad at a professor who was talking to me about African-American history. I said, "You don't know anything about African-American history." I said, "I know more about it than you do." He said, the difference is, Dorothy, I've studied it. You lived it. I'm standing on the outside and I'm seeing it. And so I do see it from a different perspective. And I've taken that with me all these years. So when I hear you talk, it's a little different because you're studying the people like me. I'm living it. And I haven't stepped back really to really see it. I feel the hurt, the pain, and the anguish. but you're doing the study. And I think we need to have conversations with people like you who actually haven't lived it, but you studied it, to share what you, the way you see it. And we need to understand, and I know about the legacy of slavery, if there weren't good white people, we would not have been as far as we are today, black people. And you probably have read the book Forced into Glory. It's a book about Abraham Lincoln. We think of him as a great emancipator. Well, he was forced into glory. You know that. Mm-hmm. You're shaking right. your head. Yes. That if he could have kept the states together and slavery could have gone on, we would still be slaves.
Right. That's one important part that's brought about in the 1619 Project. Many people are unaware of these parts of our history. Mm-hmm. That's excellent. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're discussing the 1619 Project from the New York Times. This is an initiative that has, or a project, I should say, that has brought a lot of praise, but a lot of condemnation as well. Newt Gingrich tweeted, and I'm quoting here, "The New York Times 1619 Project should make its slogan, 'All the propaganda we want to brainwash you with.'" Others have characterized the project as an attempt to delegitimize democracy, as an effort to stoke division in our country. I'll bring it back to you, Dr. Roberts. Are you surprised?
No. to be honest, no. I think what we see reflected in comments like that from Newt Gingrich, Senator Ted Cruz, I think, was also critical of the project. You know, a lot of people are upset because the 1619 Project really places slavery at the center of the American experience, at the center of American democracy. And I think some people really would like to see slavery as an aberration, as something that is outside of the American experience. Oh, it was just a blip on the radar, but we did what we needed to do, and we abolished slavery, and we moved on. But what the 1619 Project is saying is, no, actually, from the very beginning of our country, before the founding of our country, 1619, back in the colonial era, way back in the colonial era, slavery was every much of a part of our experience as democracy, as freedom, as equality. And in fact, what the project is doing is really driving home the point, which slaves themselves said, former slaves, runaway slaves, and then later scholars, driving home the point that the freedom of some people was dependent upon the unfreedom of other people.
Can I jump in here? I think some of these criticisms that the project is delegitimizing democracy, or I think you could probably lump them under a broader rubric of that it's sort of unpatriotic, right? That it's not celebrating America and its history enough. I think that somewhat simply reflects failure to even read the essays. Just take Nicole Hannah Jones's opening essay that frames the entire project. She's the African-American journalist of the New York Times who initially pitched this earlier this year, conceived of the entire thing. If you read her essay, it's basically a meditation on, or begins at least with a meditation and concludes with this as well, on her father and her father's relationship to patriotism in the United States. And she begins by talking about being a young girl growing up, I think in Iowa, if I'm not mistaken. Her father, African-American man, is a veteran, and he flies an American flag out in front of her house. And she said she didn't know a single other black family where a flag flew. She knew tons of white kids in Iowa who were parents with flags, but no other African-Americans. She didn't quite understand it, was almost embarrassed about it because she, you know, was growing to know her own, the history of her own country. And her essay really kind of explores how she has come to think, and through her own experiences, but also through her exploration of American history, through exploration of the history of slavery, of fights against Jim Crow, fights against slavery by African-Americans, that it actually was African-Americans in many cases who forced the United States to try to live up to ideals that are enshrined in the Constitution, enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. As she put it, that black people are perfecters of American democracy. And so she would argue that she is truly patriotic, and she, this is her country. She's laying claim to the country, but not doing it by whitewashing out the bad stuff, but by saying, yes, we've been here. African Americans have been here since 1619 for 400 years, and that must be recognized in our struggle to push the United States to live up to these proclaimed ideals, that has to be at the center of any understanding of the American experience.
I'm so glad you brought up her essay. You know, she says in her essay that she's 43 years old and that she is of the first generation of African Americans who were born into true freedom in this nation. I'm 43 years old and African American, and that's something, that's a reality that I have lived with my whole life. I have a very complicated feeling about that, that the world I was born into was so different than the world that my father and my aunts and my uncles lived in. And what really struck me about her essay was this idea that it was the work of civil rights activists. It was the work of African Americans that enabled, empowered America to live up to this idea of democracy that we've talked about for so long, but have not actually realized for many of our citizens. Dorothy Smith, I'd love to hear how you feel about this, about the idea that it is truly, and I'm going to quote her, we were once told by virtue of our bondage that we can never be American, but it was by virtue of our bondage that we became the most American of all. How does that strike you?
I taught Constitution for 5 years in Southwest Fresno. And what I would always tell my students, you learn the Constitution because it wasn't intended for us. If you know the Constitution, you will have a weapon. And that's the way I look at the Constitution. It was written by people who owned slaves. It wasn't about us, but if you know the Constitution, you can have something to fight with. You know, kids thought it was boring, blah, blah. But I feel it can be a weapon. When you look back, it really hurts me to think that we, the people, we believe it. We believe, as a black person, we believe that that Constitution really was for us. We were not even included. They weren't even thinking about us. You couldn't vote, blah, blah. So we really need to understand that Constitution. And in today's world, we need to understand it as Americans so that we can make it work for us. And as a black person and black people, we need to learn it. We need to underline it. We need to see those things that where we were actually left out and see how we can make it work for us. Because this is my country. And you talked about your parents' generation, the 60s, the civil rights. And if you, and I'm doing this right now, doing the songs of the 60s. We really had songs of the 60s that spoke to us. This is my country. If I had a choice of colors, we are winners. Wake up everybody. Some of those songs from the 60s when we were really out there trying to get our rights. We need to understand that. And I gave a presentation at Fresno City College using some of those songs and the history of black folks. We war, what is it good for? Those types of things we were speaking because it was a hurting time. We had to do those kind of things. James Brown, saying it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Just open up the door and I get it myself. That was hurting. And so that's what we need to understand. And your generation, your parents can understand that. Those songs came out of hurt. And it wasn't about this ugliness. And don't get me wrong about the music today. But it was a message. There was a message in the music. And that message in the music, I think, is what led us through the 60s to try to make the world a better place.
Right. Dr. Parks, you, from what I understand, intend to use these essays in your classes in the upcoming semester. I'm curious, from your perspective, what was your reaction to this reframing of the contributions of African Americans toward the realization of democracy? And how do you think that will resonate amongst your students?
I think they will enjoy the material in there, and it goes very well with post-traumatic slave syndrome. So I think that in general they get mad when they know exactly what happened, but they need to know, and especially they need to move on to the healing. Another part of the class is celebrating the achievements of African Americans that they were never taught in school, as well as celebrating the achievements of Africans that they were also never taught in school. A lot of the students that enroll in Umoja are really hungry to know about their culture.
And I'm sorry, for our listeners, can you just explain what that is?
Umoja means unity in Kiswahili, and the program includes courses. So the English class is grounded in African American culture, the student development class, the library class that supports the research that they will do in the writing class and write their research papers. And they have mentors. We go on academic and cultural trips, support HBCUs. I took students on a tour of that. And Umoja is a statewide organization. There are 70 Umoja programs in the state of California.
Great, thank you. So, Dr. Keitel, how optimistic are you that projects like this are going to contribute to a larger conversation taking place about race in America? I mean, we're at a very volatile moment in our country's history. And how do you think this kind of material is going to land?
That's a tough question. I suppose I see the 1619 project. It's amazing. It's unique. It's got the resources of the New York Times. You know, they devoted an entire magazine, Sunday magazine, to this project. So it's caught a lot of attention. Whether that's going to be lasting attention, I'm not so sure. I do think it's part of a larger groundswell of interest in starting to tell the truth a little bit more about our past and our enslaved past in particular. This country faces grave problems, many of which stem from the legacies of slavery, and just correcting understandings of the past and not seeing the connections to the present and to the future, I think, is the wrong way to go about it. I'm a historian of the past, and that's where I focus my attention. But I think that one of the things I like about it is the way it does try to look at the ways the legacies of slavery have shaped modern American practices, whether it be modern capitalism, problems like mass incarceration. And I don't know whether just telling the truth is enough. It's a start, but there's got to be a lot of other efforts. Right now we have people who are Ms. Smith was talking about the Constitution and using the Constitution, and the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments are part of the Constitution. They're part of the great positive legacy of the aftermath of slavery, but they're people who are working systematically today on the political right trying to undermine the 14th and 15th Amendments, questioning birthright citizenship from the 14th Amendment, working to dissuade voting, undercut any sort of effort to ensure the rights of the 15th Amendment. So I don't think I'm totally glass half full about what it's going to do, but it's a good start.
And Dr. Parks, we just have a minute or two before we wrap up. Your thoughts on the impact this will have?
I think it depends on who does what with it. I think it's incumbent upon the Black community to make sure we educate ourselves about it and not necessarily leave it up to institutions to do something with it, to make sure that parents are talking to their children about it, that community centers, maybe churches, Black churches are having discussions on this. So I think it's incumbent upon Black people to read it, to study it, and then talk about where do we go from here? How do we heal from here? What are we going to do next?
Well, thank you all for bringing your perspective to this conversation. It's very important. So thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.